Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Well, the state of emergency is ending, and the province of Ontario is reopening, but not all at once. The government has outlined a three-stage process for reopening, but at least the golfers will finally be happy. It's Tuesday, May 25th, 2021, so let's get to it. Well, JMM, have you played a round of golf yet?
I'll tell you, Steve, it's like COVID-19 never happened. I've played exactly as many rounds of golf as I normally would have if this weren't a pandemic.
Okay. So that means zero. I get
zero,
you. Okay.
Correct. It's a nice round number, fittingly.
Well, we can happily point out now that Ontario is no longer the only jurisdiction in North America forbidding people from playing golf. There's quite a bit of detail to get through here, so let's do this stage by stage by stage. Start off by telling us, as of this past Saturday morning, what is now allowed that was previously off limits?
Lots of things have reopened. Basically, a lot of the outdoor amenities that were closed in April have now reopened. So that's basketball courts and baseball diamonds. And, I will say that I definitely saw some civil disobedience in Toronto's parks and playgrounds last week that, I think people were playing some illegal baseball, but those are now legal again. And marinas
well,
are
remember,
launch...
John Michael, stealing is part of baseball, right? Stealing base has always, theft and crime have always been part of baseball. Anyway, I've interrupted. Go ahead.
I knew it was dangerous even to raise the topic of baseball. Marinas are allowed to launch boats again and can serve food for takeout, something that will mean a great deal in some parts of the province. BMX and skate parks are allowed again. I was reading the regulation when they made it public on Thursday, and I had to laugh at this bit. As of May 22nd, 2021, it is legal to operate ski hills, snowmobile trails, and tobogganing hills once more.
Hear, hear. Oh, that's great news. Okay. Well, now that leads us to the three stages by which the province will be reopened. And let's go through them one by one. Stage one includes what?
The emphasis in stage one is still very much on outdoor activities, but, some things become possible. Outdoor gatherings of 10 people, outdoor dining of 4 people per table, outdoor fitness classes and personal training, those become legal. Non-essential retail, that's, retailers who aren't, food or pharmacies or the LCBO. They are still under some serious constraints. They can only have about 15% of their normal capacity indoors, and malls are still closed. But campsites and campgrounds do open up in stage one.
And what has to happen before we can actually begin the stage one reopening?
The province wants at least 60% of the adult population having had their first shot, and they want some of the major public health indicators all looking good, things like low numbers of new cases and ICU capacity looking much better than it does right now. That 60% vaccination threshold, if we haven't already reached it as of Tuesday morning, we will very shortly.
Well, I'm not sure the low case count is where we want it to be right now, because towards the end of last week, we were still up around, anywhere from 2,000 to 2,500 a day. So when does the province estimate better case counts, better vaccination rates? When do they estimate that could all happen?
You're right that the average, the 7-day moving average that we've been looking at basically for, 16 months or whatever now, is still about 2,000 new cases. They want to see that come down substantially, and they are sort of tentatively scheduling June 14th or the week of June 14th as the time that stage one could begin.
And presumably, if we flatten the curve sooner than that, it's possible we could go into stage one sooner than that?
In theory, I guess it is possible, but I wouldn't expect it to be much earlier. If cases simply drop through the basement and, we're at zero new cases or something like that, then they might move sooner. But I certainly wouldn't expect much more than a week early.
Gotcha. Okay, that's stage one. What's in stage two?
Stage two, again, the emphasis is still very much on outdoor activities, but indoor retail does get to expand its capacity slightly to 25%. Personal care services, there where people can wear masks the entire time, which means haircuts, folks. those become legal in stage two. Outdoor theaters, water parks, amusement parks, those kinds of things can reopen, as well as overnight summer camps.
And again, if everything goes according to Hoyle, that would put the stage two reopening when? Sometime in July?
The government says that they won't be moving any faster through these phases than at three-week intervals. They want to give plenty of time to make sure that nothing goes badly wrong when they start reopening. So if we do, in fact, enter stage one on June 14th, that gets us to stage two by July 5th. And we know that the premier has already said that they're hoping summer camps will be able to reopen in early July. So that more or less tracks. But there is another vaccination benchmark that we need to hit. That is 70% of adults with one shot and 20% with their second shots.
So a ways to go before we hit that. All right, that's stage two. Stage three, that reopening would include what?
You know, this is where the indoor stuff really starts to reopen. Indoor dining with some limits, indoor movie theaters, indoor religious services at higher capacities, museums, zoos, aquariums, all of the things I'm going to be boring my daughter with this summer. we start to have a lot more options. And the government does have another benchmark, though. They want up to 80% of adults vaccinated with their first doses and 25% with their second doses before we get to stage three.
And again, presuming we continue to flatten the curve and there's no fourth eruption of COVID-19, that would presumably put the stage three reopening late July, early August, something like that?
If we spend no more than 21 days in each of these previous stages, my count of 42 days from June 14th makes it July 26th. So you could, in theory, see a lot of things reopen for the August long weekend, for example.
Okay. A few more follow-up questions here. Do we know whether this conforms to exactly what the government's so-called science table of advisors is advising, or do we think the cabinet is freelancing a bit here?
Steve, freelancing from the cabinet? I'm shocked you would even suggest something like that.
You sound like Claude Rains in Casablanca right now. But anyway, moving on.
Shocked to discover there's gambling going on here.
Exactly.
Based on the modeling we saw on Thursday and, you know, the consistent advice from the science table on, for example, the safety of outdoor activities, you know, I think it's fair to say this plan largely conforms to their advice. And we haven't always been able to say that about things that come out of cabinet. Given past events, I think, you know, I certainly heard from a lot of people on Twitter that worry the government will be tempted to reopen things too soon and risk a rebound in new cases. And, you know, that is an epidemiological possibility, despite the high rates of vaccination that we're seeing. But, you know, the modeling showed that reopening in early June presented a risk of the rebound. And, you know, for now, the premier and the government have decided not to chance it. They are pushing that reopening to the middle of June. And, you know, the premier says it's specifically because of the modeling advice that they received.
Well, it's interesting. The premier and his cabinet and government are being super cautious on all of this. And it just reminded me when you said it looks like August before movie theaters will be open. It reminds me that for the Agenda TV show, I interviewed Ellis Jacob, who's the president and CEO of Cineplex. Only 1,600 screens across the country, you know, thousands of employees. And, you know, he felt pretty comfortable when I interviewed him over a month ago that they were going to see theaters open by June. But apparently that's not going to happen, is it?
Not based on the plan we saw on Thursday, and I believe there's always been already been some pretty, let's say, spirited and negative reaction from some business groups who are left out of stages one and two. And, you know, I understand it's been a really hard year for everybody, including business owners. But as you say, this is the government being very, very cautious.
Mm-hmm. All right. One of the biggest questions that went unaddressed at the government's announcement last week was, what is the fate of our public education system? Now, admittedly, there's only about 6 weeks or so left in the school year, but is there any indication yet as to whether or not the schools might reopen, even if only for a few weeks?
No clear indication yet. The modeling table had suggested that reopening schools even in mid-June might cause a 6 to 11% increase in daily new infections. What's interesting is that Dr. Adelstein Brown from the University of Toronto did present that potential increase as possibly manageable, given some of the other things that are working in our favor in Ontario right now. The premier says he doesn't want to risk it. Basically, for whatever reason, the government is being super cautious, as we've said repeatedly already now, and does not want to risk that increase. And so for now, schools are going to stay closed.
Well, okay, how do I do this? I'm not second guessing anybody here, right? They're the deciders. They have to make the decisions. I'm just going to ask some questions here. We know from empirically provable evidence that COVID-19, thankfully, seems not to be fatal in young people. Young people go to school. The explanation I had always heard to date was, we can't have the schools open and the kids getting infected, even though it's extremely unlikely anybody's going to die from it in the schools, because the kids could get infected, bring the stuff home, and infect their parents. But we've now got more than half the parents vaccinated with at least one vaccine. So the chances of that happening are much lower. Am I asking ridiculous questions here, or is there a path to this that is being unaddressed as we speak?
You know, one of the hardest things to distinguish in the pandemic has been the difference between a public health indicator and a person's own personal safety, right? So the fact that you might have your first shot of a vaccine obviously gives you some protection. But even people who are not individually protected by a vaccine dose are more protected when lots of other people also have that vaccine. And so, you know, we talk about the safety of schools, and obviously teachers want to be vaccinated. And frankly, at this point, you know, we even want, if we had enough vaccines to do it, we would want teenage high school students to be vaccinated too, right? Everybody over 12 and over. And that would give everybody a lot of confidence and a lot of measures of safety. But if case counts are falling, schools are also safer, right? If case counts are falling because lots and lots of people are vaccinated, even if every individual teacher and every individual high school student is not vaccinated, then people are safer. Obviously, that doesn't end the argument in the same way that, well, frankly, none of these arguments ever end.
Right.
I do think it's worth considering. When we talk about the safety of schools, we are not simply talking about whether every teacher who wants a vaccine has had one yet.
Well, I raise these questions because I did have a conversation this past week with someone who's been on the provincial education scene for probably half a century, and she only wanted to speak on background here, doesn't want to make a fuss, but raised some interesting questions. She was adamant that reopening the schools, even if only for a few weeks, was absolutely imperative. And interestingly enough, JMM, it had nothing to do with academics. Her argument was strictly for mental health reasons, for socialization reasons. Kids need to be back with kids. And now that the majority of adults in the province have had at least one vaccination shot, she says we can and should do this, even if it means holding classes outdoors, out of concerns about old ventilation systems, for example. Kids need to be back in school. And that is apparently not the provincial government's plan right now. I haven't seen it, but have you picked up any indication as to whether the province is prepared to revisit this decision before the school year is out?
Certainly nothing public, nothing that they gave no sign of it at the media avail on Thursday. You know, the premier did make an allegation that teachers' unions had threatened an injunction if they were forced to go back to in-class learning. It may not be obvious to all of our listeners, but like a teachers' union can't actually just get an injunction. They have to go argue for one in front of a judge, and the judge is going to weigh things like, you know, the government's right to set education policy, that kind of thing. So, I'll just say I'm skeptical of that claim from the premier and move on. But the other thing he said is that he wants consensus on reopening. And, you know, there are both medical and political reasons why he may not get consensus, right? There are doctors in this province right now who are saying that reopening schools is a pathway to a fourth wave and, you know, bringing the hospital system back to the brink of collapse. We don't have to credit every single accusation made against the teachers' unions, but I think it's fair to say that there are also political reasons why the premier might not get the consensus he's looking for. But, you know, when has Ontario ever had consensus in its education system? You know, he might just actually have to make the decision.
I know the answer to that question, and the answer is never.
Right.
Because that's the way it works in a democracy.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk vaccines. As we just indicated, a significant chunk of the population now has one shot. We hear a lot about these huge number of AstraZeneca doses that are in the freezer somewhere, waiting for their fate to be determined. Is the province any closer to a decision on whether that supply can be used for people's second dose?
You know, I told somebody on Twitter that I would shut up about this issue if the government made its decision by the end of the week, and they did. So now I have to break that promise and talk about it just a little bit more on this podcast. On Friday morning, Dr. David Williams announced that people who had received their first dose of a vaccine in the form of an AstraZeneca shot between March 10th and March 19th of this year will be eligible to receive their second dose as an AstraZeneca shot next week. So two important things here. One, this is going to hopefully use up the, I've heard differing numbers, but between 45 and 55,000 doses of AstraZeneca that we have on hand that were in danger of expiring and going to waste unused. The other important thing to note for our listeners, some of whom, like you, may have gotten the AstraZeneca shot, is that this is a slightly shorter interval between the first and second shot than is the recommended dose. For AstraZeneca, the recommended dose interval was always 12 weeks. And so this is going to be something more like 10 weeks. And so that's slightly shorter. Dr. Williams and Dr. Dirk Heyer both said that, you know, this is not going to massively compromise the effectiveness of the vaccine. And so if people want to get their second shot as an AstraZeneca shot, people who were at the sort of the front of the line almost 3 months ago now, will now be eligible.
You know, as you said those dates, March 10th and March 19th, the dates within which people got their first shots, I started to think to myself, I know I got my first jab in March, but I can't remember what date. I'm going to have to go back to the calendar and see if I am, in fact, eligible for the second dose of AZ, because my first dose was AZ. So, okay, thank you for that. I'm going to check that after we're done here. Now, it wouldn't, of course, be a Doug Ford news conference if he didn't take a poke at the Prime Minister and urge him to tighten up the borders. And of course, that happened. Just a reminder, we are not being critical of the Premier for suggesting the borders ought to be tightened up. Epidemiologists say the borders probably should be tightened up to ensure that the variants of concern don't penetrate the province more than they already have. And we point this out because science also tells us that overseas travel accounts for about 10% of the positive test cases we're experiencing. And yet, the Premier seems to focus 90% of his attention on here's how we're going to fight COVID-19 energy, rather than the many other things that might actually work more effectively. It's pretty obvious that naked politics are at play here, and the word has gone out that we're almost at, you know, T-minus 1 year and counting until the next election. So it's a good time to start fighting with the federal Liberals, even if it means taking tens of thousands of dollars of PC party ads out. Anyway, lest I get on a rant here, is there any indication that the federal government is prepared to re-examine the status of overseas flights, particularly from COVID-19 hotspots such as India or Brazil, for example?
Before I answer your question, I do want to add one other sort of wrinkle to this that I think is worth our listeners keeping in mind, that, you know, Doug Ford is wrong about the salience of the border right now. But as we get more and more people vaccinated and as domestic community spread of COVID-19 shrinks, and that's obviously what we're all hoping will happen as we vaccinate more and more people, the border will actually become a more important part of this story as we go from, you know, basically just trying to get our own house in order to having a mostly vaccinated population that we're just primarily trying to protect from new variants of concern. We're not there yet, and it's not like you can sort of retroactively make what the premier is saying correct. But as, you know, trying to think a few steps ahead in this pandemic, which unfortunately will last long after it's under control here in Canada. That was just one thing I wanted to sort of say. Your question about flights from India or Brazil. The federal government has extended the current prohibition on direct flights from India and Pakistan until June 21st. This was a measure that was brought in earlier this year when India started to go through its latest really tragic wave of COVID-19. You know, lots of people will say this is an imperfect measure. It only really bans direct flights. You can still fly to a third country from India and then fly into Canada. But that is the current policy. Another current policy, the closure of the U.S. border to non-essential travel has also been extended into June. These are both just maintaining the existing policies. These are not changing anything. So we haven't really seen much sign that Ottawa sees any kind of urgent need to change much at either the land border crossings or the airports. And apropos of your comment that the province's position on this, how to put this, maybe more about political science than epidemiological science, the Angus Reid Research Organization has just come out with some fresh surveys, some fresh polling indicating that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau now has a 43% approval rating. That is up 2 points from April. But maybe more significantly, it's more than twice as popular as Doug Ford's numbers in Ontario. The federal government as a whole has a 50% approval rating on handling the pandemic, which we probably don't need to remind our listeners is a substantially higher approval rating than what Ontario's government had the last time we pulled it.
Well, let me build a little bit on that as well, because we might point out that the same survey has got the federal NDP leader Jagmeet Singh with a 46% approval rating, which is even a little ahead of Prime Minister Trudeau. The Conservative Party leader Erin O'Toole has just a 27% approval rating. And I only mention these numbers because we know that traditionally in Ontario politics, there is, from time to time, a lot of spillover between the popularity or unpopularity of the federal parties and their leaders onto the provincial scene. So presumably, this is good news for the provincial Liberals, the provincial New Democrats, not so much for the provincial Tories.
The other thing that I think comes to mind is certainly looking at those numbers for Erin O'Toole is that the current leader of the Conservative Party may now be the second one in a row to wish that somebody else were Premier of Ontario right now.
Well, but as I always mention, and in the interest of fairness, right, polls are a great indication of what people thought yesterday. They're not predictive. They don't tell you what people are going to think tomorrow. And I well remember when he was Premier of Ontario, Bob Rae's line, when people always said to them, here's what the polls say. What do you think? He would say, I'm in the business of trying to change polls, right?
Yes.
So campaigns change polls. Policy changes polls. Good news changes polls. So does bad news. So
yes,
everybody take a chill pill. Yeah, exactly. All right, let's conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes, as we do every week. We're going to have that for you immediately after we ask you to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Tell us what you like or didn't. Either way, it lets others know about this podcast and perhaps puts it on their radar screens as well.
You can also shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here now, my quote of the week. Now, JMM, I think the easy quote of the week would have been Premier Ford's challenging Quebec Premier François Legault to a bet on the Maple Leafs Canadiens playoff series. So I'm not going there. That's just way too easy. Instead, you and I have both decided to focus on the leader of Her Majesty's loyal opposition. And I have to say, one of these quotes she may like and the other one, not so much. Let's start with the not so much. Andrea Horvath, look it, let's just say it. She's received a lot of compliments on this podcast, in previous episodes for using her bully pulpit as opposition leader to highlight issues she thinks the government has screwed up on, whether it's a lack of a paid sick day program or getting teachers vaccinated so we can reopen schools or getting more help for tenants or whatever, myriad issues. But Ms. Horvath had a significant announcement to make last week in calling for a full-blown judicial inquiry into the province's handling of COVID-19. She's promised to do it if she forms the next government. Stephen Del Duca, the Liberal leader, heard it. He's promised to do the same thing. And when she came out into the South Lawn of Queen's Park to make that announcement, she simply botched it. She messed up a name of a couple of her MPPs who were with her at the announcement. She forgot the critic portfolio for one of those MPPs. And then when it came time to announce the full-blown inquiry into COVID-19, well, she got that wrong too. Have a listen.
We have the critic for, now I'm forgetting one of them. Oh, Laura May Lindo, the critic for anti-racism. And I didn't mention Butila Karpoche, who is our critic for childcare and early learning. That's why today we're calling for a full judicial inquiry into long-term care. Inquiry into the entire response of this government to COVID-19.
Now, pollster Greg Lyle told us last week on this podcast that unlike in most election cycles, people are actually paying attention now, a year before the next election. The New Democrats are the so-called government in waiting, right? They're the official opposition. They're only 23 seats shy of a majority government. They need to convey competence at the very least, and that announcement didn't do it. Okay. Having said that, JMM, what have you got?
My quote of the week is, as we say, also from Andrea Horvath, and let's say it's a stronger performance. She was speaking last Thursday after the province's reopening announcement, and she was asked by CP reporter Sean Jeffords about the premier's claim that he needs a consensus on reopening schools, and here's what she said.
I mean, I think it's balderdash. The guy likes to talk out of his hat, and I think that's what came to the top of his mind when that question was asked. Who knows how this premier makes his decisions? I mean, let's face it, all the way along, it's been, you know, a deep, dark secret of how, in terms of how Doug Ford makes his decisions.
That's NDP leader Andrew Horvath. And Steve, I'm going to confess, I picked this clip almost entirely because of the use of the word balderdash.
Poppycock, my friend. Well, that was episode 113 of the On Poly podcast, produced by Katie O'Connor, editing from Donnie Swanson, production support from Nikki Ashworth and Jonathan Hallowell. JMM, as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Stay safe, Steve.